had amazing success with the topics you've picked for your different documentaries. They've all turned out to be really great stories. Do you think that's luck, good planning, or kind of a combination of both?
Well, you know, I guess I subscribe to the old adage that luck equals opportunity meeting preparation. So, you know, certainly I think we've been lucky, you know, over the years in the kinds of situations we've encountered, but I also think we've handled the situations very well. You know, Paradise Lost started out, you know, as a story about guilty teenagers. HBO sent us on a mission to go make a film about people that looked like they were guilty. But I think we were wise enough to, after spending a few months in town before the trials, realize that these guys were not the bad guys. In fact, it looked like they were wrongfully arrested. So, you know, we used our investigative tools to determine something else was happening. You know, you could say it was lucky that when we arrived to make the Metallica film, the band was kind of crumbling and falling apart. But that was originally, it was just supposed to be a little behind-the-scenes shoot, you know, a band going into the studio for the first time in 5 years, and at most be a 20, 25-minute little featurette that was going to be slapped onto the back of a physical CD in the era when record companies were still trying to sell CDs. And when we arrived, we were told, you know, we're probably not going to make this record and, you know, you should go home. We figured out how to stay and, you know, turn it into a film. So, you know, luck definitely plays a role in it. I think there's a lot of talented people who, you know, have great stories. As a juror on many film festivals, I see, you know, people who have great films, but for whatever reason haven't gotten the attention they deserve. So I'm the first one to say we've been, you know, very lucky over the years. I've been very lucky over the years, but, you know, I also work really hard.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about your new film. I watched it over the weekend about Whitey Bulger, and what kind of drew you to this project, and did you know a lot about the case before you started filming up there in Boston?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been fascinated by the Bulger case as somebody who is a longtime true crime person, and somebody, more importantly, not just true crime as a genre, but, you know, somebody who has looked into, you know, when the justice system runs off the rails, somebody who's interested in institutional corruption. I mean, those are themes that have been throughout all of my films, mm-hmm. Unless they're music films, of course. You know, I jokingly tell my friends I either do murder or music, so the music films are, I guess, their own category. But I've always been fascinated by his story. In many ways, it's kind of an irresistible tale of, you know, a guy who rules Boston's underworld for 25 years, doesn't even get stopped for a traffic ticket, you know, is allowed to kill, but, you know, while allegedly being an FBI informant. And, you know, when the Massachusetts police state police, you know, have had enough of FBI inaction, start closing in, and then the FBI tip him off and he goes on the lam. I mean, it's just, obviously I'm not the only one who has been amazed and intrigued by the story, because the other thing that fascinates me about Bulger is just, you know, the amount of literature that exists about him. I mean, I've never seen a contemporary bad guy so pass into kind of the public consciousness and the cultural myth-making machine, you know, to the point where there's a dozen books about him. Johnny Depp is playing him right now as we speak, mm-hmm. you know, shooting Black Mass. Jack Nicholson, you know, his character in The Departed obviously was very loosely, I would say, but, you know, word was that it's based on the Bulger character, and that was the fantasy, that it was based on the Bulger character. I've just always, as a storyteller, I'm just always fascinated by, you know, how a narrative is spun, how a legend is made, you know, and so for all those reasons, I've been fascinated. But you know, never actually thought about making a film because, you know, it was such a well-worn tire with all those books and movies in development and other TV shows. But when it was announced that he was actually being brought back to trial, you know, to stand trial in Massachusetts last summer, that's when I thought, oh, okay, maybe I do have something to add. You know, I could take the present tense trial, you know, the unfolding trial, and kind of use that as a springboard to examine, you know, what made him possible, how was he allowed to operate, to try to separate the man from the myth a little bit, and to try to understand, you know, why it is that people are so fascinated by him. So that was kind of the idea, is, you know, use the trial to actually get into the reality of his story.
I was, as somebody, I followed the case for a long time too, and I, when I watched it the other night, I thought that that was really interesting, when you, the recorded conversations with him and his defense attorney, like hearing him speak, I had never heard that before. That was really interesting to me.
Yeah. You know, it is, to those who have followed the story, having Bulger in the movie, in my movie, you know, is actually quite a thing. It's quite an achievement because he's never agreed to, you know, participate in anything. I mean, some people have heard his voice because he's been, you know, recorded on wiretaps, and even during the summer's trial, this past summer's trial, you know, some of his conversations with reporters were was recorded. I'm sorry, some of the conversations with his family members was recorded, and that was reported on at trial. So, you know, some people have heard him, you know, be, you know, as the subject of, you know, law enforcement recordings, but nobody's ever actually heard him give his point of view. And just because he's in the film giving his point of view doesn't necessarily mean he's telling us the truth, but yeah. Nonetheless, it's fascinating to just hear how he puts a sentence together, his turn of phrase, his demeanor, you know, the timbre of his voice. I mean, I think all of that is just fascinating. You know, and I want the audience to ask themselves, you know, is this a guy who's trying to, like, you know, manipulate the audience through the filmmaker into believing, you know, unsubstantiated claims that he was not a rat and he didn't kill women? Or does he have something legitimate to say about the nature of corruption and how deeply corrupted the system was that allowed him to operate? I mean, that's the essential question of the movie.
I have a hard time, like, with all the different webs going through it. It's, I don't know, it's just hard to believe the whole thing actually happened. It's almost, it's too good to be true, as far as from a somebody who's trying to make a film's point of view.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the challenges of the film is that, you know, I agree with your point of view, that, you know, it's hard to tell who's telling the truth, and, you know, and that's kind of what the film is about. That's why Kevin Weeks, you know, at the end of the film, he's got one of the last things to say, which to me is kind of a summation of what you've just seen, which is he basically says, you know, and obviously Kevin Weeks was, you know, Bulger's, you know, young protege and right-hand man, and they spent every, you know, significant amount of time together every day. And, you know, he says that until everyone starts telling the truth, nobody's going to know the truth, and that everyone kind of shapes the narrative, each in their own way, for their own benefit. And that's exactly what's happened here is, you know, I think the truth, I think the message of the film is that everyone has a different spin on reality, but that what the truth that rises to the top is that something really rotten in Boston happened that was much more systemic than the authorities want people to know.
Right.
And the idea that John Connolly, you know, Bulger's handler, if you believe he was an informant, you know, the government wants you to believe that all the bad behavior that went on in Boston was one bad agent and his corrupt supervisor's responsibility. But I think what the truth that kind of floats from the top is that the corruption was much deeper, and that, you know, there's a lot of credibility to the idea that Bulger might not have been an informant. And what does that mean about the integrity of our institutions of justice, you know? And so I think it's okay that we don't know exactly what happened and that there's multiple viewpoints, because the larger emotional truth rises to the top, which is we don't know the full story. The full story was much more corrupt than the official story. And for the sake of the victims' families who lost loved ones because a guy was not taken off the streets who should have been, you know, these victims' families deserve much more accountability from the institutions that allowed these guys to operate.
Right. I want to back up a little bit. Some of your, you know, your earlier documentaries, Brothers Keeper and Paradise Lost, it seems like the places that you went to make these films kind of have their own, they're almost a character in themselves in the film, like that the town in Brothers Keeper, and especially like West Memphis.
You know, I think definitely we were attempting to, you know, take people to places you don't normally go in cinema, explore kind of American subcultures. That was definitely a part of it, so I agree with you there. I think in today's ubiquitous video age where everything is filmed and everything's been put on camera, I think it's harder and harder to get to that level of authenticity and newness and uniqueness. But, you know, one of the things that we you know, consciously thought about in choosing our subjects back in those days was to take people to places you don't normally go and to meet people you don't normally see on the screen. And both Paradise Lost and Brothers Keeper kind of fit into that.
Right. I mean, you obviously spent a ton of time down in West Memphis, especially like in the mid-90s, you know, when there was no internet and everything like that. What was it like down there being so cut off from everybody?
It was a unique experience because, you know, we were experiencing prejudice and a bloodlust to convict three guys who we thought were probably not guilty. And so, you know, it just was a, you know, it was a weird experience. It was a slightly alienating experience, whereas, you know, the Brothers Keeper experience, all of those townspeople were exemplifying kind of the best of American values. You know, these were guys, you know, this community was rallying around Delbert Ward and his brothers, trying to help them out of a, you know, situation in which they believed he had been, you know, a semi, you know, literate, not very bright guy, had been coerced into signing a false confession, and they weren't going to allow that to happen. And they believed he didn't kill his brother. And, you know, some of the best of old-time American values were on display in that community. And so that was a very different experience, because there was the joy of being a part of getting that message out. And in many ways, Paradise Lost, you know, the experience in West Memphis was, you know, the mirror image. You know, I certainly don't want to criticize the parents of the victims. I mean, they always will have my sympathy. You know, I can't imagine anything worse than losing a child. And, you know, I cut victims' parents and family members all the slack that they deserve. You know, even to this day, you know, while most of the families have come to believe that the West Memphis Three are innocent, you know, the Moore family still fervently believes in the West Memphis Three's guilt and thinks we're horrible human beings for having made these films and that the films are manipulative. And, you know, that hurts. And they've said some really rotten things about us. And when Paradise Lost Three was up for an Academy Award, you know, they wrote the Academy saying, you know, the film is fake and shouldn't be considered, and, you know, so all that stuff hurts. But even despite all that, I have nothing but sympathy for them, because, you know, it's a horrible experience. I mean, I wouldn't know, thank God, but I can only imagine, you know, knock on wood, it's just nothing could be worse. Having said all that, however, there was a bloodlust in the town. There was, you know, it was a very religious, fundamentalist community where the belief in heaven and hell was quite real. And while I don't want to criticize religion and religiosity, there was just, you know, a desire to convict these guys from the local media down to the all the residents. And in part, that's because, you know, this is a part of the world where people believe the police and believe the prosecutors, and the, you know, the authorities were saying that on a scale of 1 to 10, this was an 11 in terms of the solidity mm-hmm. of the evidence, you know. But it was just, you know, so the internet and all that stuff, you know, that has less to do with, you know, the feelings of alienation we felt. Like, we felt the case was quite weak and quite circumstantial, and the media, the local media back then, you know, was printing the confession, and, you know, every night there was a story about how rotten these guys were. I mean, they didn't stand a chance. And so we were witnessing, a real-life kind of witch hunt. And it just got worse as time unfolded. So, you know, the Munnsville, New York, where Brothers Keeper took place, was just, you know, a small rural farming community trying to take care of one of their own and resist, you know, charges that they thought, not resist, but fight against charges that they thought were unfair. Whereas in the South, in Arkansas, and that's not making a statement about geography, you know, mm-hmm. I'm sure there are good people everywhere and whatever, but it's just interesting how Paradise Lost, you know, the West, being in West Memphis was just the antithesis of being in Munnsville, New York.
And I read another interview with you where you said that when you, and you talked about this for a minute earlier, but when you first went down to West Memphis to film the original one, you thought you were going down there to make a real life River's Edge.
Right. I mean, yeah, that was, you know, the press coming out of Arkansas was that they were definitely guilty. There was a confession, open and shut case. You know, Sheila Nevins, who's the head of documentaries at HBO, ripped out a little article in the New York Times because she was a huge fan of Brothers Keeper and, you know, said, you know, she wanted to do a film with us. So we were talking about different ideas, and then she sent us this article. And, you know, she was interested, as were we, in, you know, making a film about disaffected youth. You know, how could three teenagers be so rotten that they could take 3 8-year-olds in the woods and, you know, ritualistically sacrifice them in their minds to the devil, which is what everyone in town believed, which is what the press was reporting, mm-hmm. what the prosecution was saying, and the police were saying, you know, this is an open and shut case. And so we went down thinking the worst of these three. And, you know, the first couple of months we were primarily spending time with the police and with the families of the victims, and had no reason to think we still weren't making a film about three guilty teenagers. But once we finally negotiated access to the West Memphis Three, although they obviously weren't called that then, but once we got access to, you know, Damien, Jason, and Jesse, and did those initial interviews, It just something didn't feel right. It's not like a light bulb went off and said, my God, they're innocent. It just didn't feel right, you know. I looked down at Jason Baldwin's little wrists, you know, and he's allegedly the knife guy wielding this big serrated hunting knife that was allegedly used and castrating these guys. And it just, you know, it just didn't feel right. You know, we just, it didn't feel right. And then, you know, getting to know the defense and understanding the case and then sitting through all those trials, you know, we just became convinced they were innocent. And so by the time that they were, you know, that final scene in Paradise Lost where Damien is and Jason are kind of chained up and led away, mm-hmm. you know, Damien off to death row, and I mean, it's amazing we got our cameras where we got them everywhere, but I remember being back there shooting that scene where they're being, you know, chained up and led away, thinking, you know, oh my God, you know, this is like real life, and these guys are, you know, have been totally screwed. You know, it really was my wake-up call, because I don't think Brothers Keeper was an advocacy film. It was pure cinema, you know, a desire to tell a cinematic, ambiguous story. You know, at the time, documentaries, believe me, we're not the only ones who have done it, but the 80s was not a very, you know, rife period of documentary making, and that kind of ambiguous human character portrait, you know, going into some world and trying to make a dramatic film that had all the kind of dramatic qualities of a good narrative film, but be documentary, which sounds so obvious and simple today. Those kinds of films were not a dime a dozen back when we were doing it. And I think, you know, we were trying to do something very cinematic, and advocacy was the last thing that's on our mind. You know, we were there for the storytelling and to take real life and turn it into, you know, real life drama from a cinematic standpoint. you know, and that was kind of the impulse with Paradise Lost originally. But seeing those guys get carted away for a crime they didn't commit kind of awakened in me the advocacy gene. And I think ever since then, you know, my documentaries aren't just about storytelling experiences, although I think that needs to be a part of it. But, you know, that's when it kind of occurred to me that films can be richly cinematic, but also, you know, help persuade people to do the right thing, you know, which clearly was not the original intent when we first started.
Right. I mean, you obviously played a huge role in getting these three guys out of prison. Do you keep in touch with them, or do you keep in touch with other people from that case?
Yeah, I mean, you know, some more than others. You know, I would say Jason Baldwin, you know, is like my long-lost son, and very much in touch with him, and we've become very close, and, you know, we stay in regular touch. You know, Damien and I have a very cordial relationship, but it's not the same as the one with Jason. Jesse's hard to keep track of. You know, he's changed his phone number quite a bit, and, you know, he stayed in Arkansas for whatever reason. You know, we haven't spoken that much because every number, you know, I check in with him from time to time, and the numbers have changed, and, you know, it's just harder to stay in touch with him. But, you know, there's a lot of people involved in the case who, you know, informally kind of stay in touch and trade information because, of course, the mission is not over. I mean, the filmmaking mission is over. I don't plan on making another film, but I think we all want to try to see the West Memphis 3 become fully exonerated instead of taking that crummy Alfred plea.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think everyone's interested in, you know, the real killer being prosecuted, which, you know, is not hugely likely, but everyone holds that hope. So, yeah, people stay in touch.
Right. And not to end on a bad note, but I wanted to ask you about your experience directing a big feature for a big studio when you made Book of Shadows, Blair Witch 2. Can you talk about that experience a little bit, coming from the world that you came from and going into that?
Yeah, you know, look, I always wanted to try my hand at doing a narrative film. And the experience of making that film, of actually shooting it, was fantastic. You know, I had pitched them on a particular approach. I mean, they sought me out to do it, and I responded with a take, with an approach, which was to create a highly satirical, this would have been pre-Scream, you know, so a self-referential, self-aware, satirical film that kind of made fun of the whole idea of doing a sequel, since there was so much pent-up venom about the idea of doing a sequel. I thought making fun of the idea of doing a sequel would be a smart way to go. And then it takes a horrifying twist at the end, so that it still fulfills the horror quotient. So the movie that I directed, you know, was a very different film than the film that was released. And so that experience, I mean, I was literally in the mixing studio with Carter Burwell, you know, listening to the score that he was creating, or in his mixing studio, rather, not in the mix for the film, but we were in the final stages of post-production. I was listening to his score, and we get a phone call from some new marketing person who decided the film needed more blood and gore and all the things that the Blair Witch Project stood against. You know, the horror in the original occurred off-screen, and so here this marketing executive wanted to, like, you know, turn my satire into a traditional slasher movie. And I literally saw that, you know, my movie taken away from me, recut, and turned into something that, you know, I was not proud of. And so that experience was extremely painful, because not only was the movie that I, you know, that I shot not released, but then it got such bad reviews, and I agreed with a lot of those reviews, you know. And so to be in a situation where you lose control, it actually is what, only until very recently have I contemplated doing another narrative film, because I never, you know, the thing I love about, you know, the documentaries I did before and since Blair Witch is that, you know, I don't have to listen to other people and see my movie get taken out of my hands, basically. You know, I'm the author of my own work, and that made it me very hesitant to go back into the narrative space. Only recently have I developed a project that I'm hoping to shoot later, that, you know, later this year, called Facing the Wind. And it's really the first time in 14 years I've decided to take a chance again, and because, you know, I feel now I have enough kind of clout, you know, that I can put myself in a situation where I'm not going to have a movie taken out of my hands. But for a long time, it just kept me away from narrative filmmaking.